Welcome to Fiber Talk, a new podcast for hobbyists who play in the fiber arts world. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And we're experienced podcasters. We've been doing podcasts every week for 5+ years in the reef aquarium hobby. And we're two people who are multi-hobby addicts, basically.
Yes, that would be accurate.
Yeah, we both keep marine aquariums, growing coral and marine fish, but we're also involved in needlework in some way or another. And but both different there too. And Christine, you your world is knitting and quilting, is that right? Is that right? Like, I don't know.
It's kind of, so I think it's almost like an older generation thing, even though I am regretting already saying that I belong to that older generation. When I was small, so my introduction sort of into fiber arts and sewing of any kind was my grandmother, when I was probably about 3, I started sewing because she would take muslin cloth and trace very basic outlines out of coloring books and pop it into embroidery hoops and give me a pretty large needle and thread and just have me sew a running stitch along the outline of the thing that she had just traced. So that was the very first thing that I ever sewed in my life. And it went from there. My grandmother was an excellent seamstress. So she taught me how to use a sewing machine, how to read a pattern, and so we went from there. And my great-grandmother was a crocheter. And at the time, she, you know, she crocheted until she passed away and she was nearly blind. And, you know, the funny thing is that I would ask her to teach me how. And she was so blindingly fast, no pun intended, that I couldn't see what she was doing. And I'd ask her to slow down and she'd say, I can't. I don't know how. So eventually, you know, she inspired me to go on and figure that out for myself, which then, of course, led to knitting, and that all led to quilting. So over the years, I've done kind of a little bit of everything between knitting and crocheting, and now I'm teaching my niece to knit, and she says, you're going too fast. So, you know, it's all come full circle. I've sewn costumes for theaters. I've done, you know, make clothing from scratch, from patterns and not from patterns. So I've kind of dabbled in a lot of areas. And so I think I'm not one of those focused hobbyists. You know, it's whatever happens to be catching my interest at the moment. So I kind of jump from one style of thing to another, go full force into it, and then move on to something else and then go back to it later. So I've got the sort of stitchery and, you know, yarn work, I guess, good habit. I'm going to call it a good habit. I think we have two good habits. One is that we've all got a stash of something somewhere, probably multiple stashes of a whole bunch of yarn and fabric and things that, you know, you're going to use someday, but then you forget what you have. So we all have that big giant stash of things. And two is that I've always got 6 or 7 different projects going on at the same time. And I can never seem to finish all of them. I'm very much a work in parallel as opposed to a linear worker. So I don't do one thing and then finish and then choose another. I've always got a few going on at a time, which probably are not good qualities. I'm going to choose to look at them as good qualities, though. My fabric and yarn hoarding. And
I think that makes you normal. I just think that makes you normal.
for someone of these hobbies, absolutely. You know, that was my grandmother had a room, a tiny room in her house that was floor to ceiling shelved. And it was exactly that. It was old bits of fabric that were going to be, you know, you would make them into something. And you know, leftover bits of yarn and all those sorts of things. So as a kid, that was like, you know, it was like a Christmas store. You just go in there and it's just a room of possibilities. You know, it's some people would look at it as junk, but for people like you or me, you look in there and you say, wow, there's so many things I could make from the things that are in this room.
That's
that's a little bit about me.
Yep. And I got involved. My mother was a knitter, and my grandmother a crocheter. And my grandmother's been gone a long time, and we still have two Afghans that she crocheted, and they are the treasured wintertime sit down in front of TV Afghans that will always be with us. And my mother was a knitter, and I always thought it was more of a hobby, but as I got older, I came to realize it was more out of necessity, mittens and hats and scarves for us, and I still have the stocking, Christmas stocking that she knitted. She knitted from a kit for each of us four kids. But I never got interested in knitting or crocheting. It just didn't interest me. And then I ran into this thing called needlepoint when I was in college. Had a girlfriend who did needlepoint and exposed me to that. And I got hooked on that. That was back in the, I don't know, probably 13 count canvas with wool fiber, and you do the design in basket weave, and then you get done, and then you had to do all that background in basket weave, and I just grew to hate that. But
And I think that's how this podcast got started, was because my experience with needlepoint was exactly that. And you and I started talking one day, and it came up that you were doing this, and you started sending me these patterns of what sort of the current, you know, status of needlepoint was. And I said, oh, this is not at all like the old cruel, you know, do a giant eagle, you know, it's nothing like it was when I was a kid, and immediately sparked my interest again. And, you know, I of course then had seven more projects to think about doing. And some of the, just the intricacies and the beautiful, beautiful yarns and silks that you were using, it just made it a completely different hobby all over again for me. So that's sort of how this all got started, was us introducing each other to, it isn't like our grandmother's knitting, right, and it isn't like our grandmother's needlepoint anymore. Take a look at what's going on currently. And then, you know, if we took off from there, and we've been talking about it ever since.
Yeah, every time we frequently before we do our weekly aquarium podcast, we'll talk about stitching of some kind. And so right now I'm doing primarily needlepoint and primarily charted pieces, but I've done crewel and plenty of cross stitch. Who hasn't? And some embroidery. So that's where my interests lie. And I just, the knitting just never did hit me. And so between the two of us, and of course I'm a misfit in this hobby because I'm male. So,
as I'm a misfit sort of in the other hobby because I'm female.
Right.
So it's all coming full circle now.
Yep. It sure does. So, we're going to do this podcast and at least two a month. And as we get going here, we'll probably increase the frequency. And for our first one, we're very excited to have my favorite designer, by far my favorite designer, Debbie Raleigh from Debbie's Designs. And we're going to get here in a bit, be able to talk with Debbie about her career and what she's done and how she's gone about developing her design business. So very excited to have that. And we hope everybody will enjoy our podcast. And if there's any feedback or somebody you want to hear, let us know, and we'll try and get them as a guest.
Yes, welcome aboard.
So, Debbie Raleigh, thanks for joining us for our first Fiber Talk podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And have to say, I'm just going to suck up to you. You're my favorite counted canvas designer. That's primarily what I do when I do needlepoint, is counted canvas work. And really enjoy your work. And I've got what I'm working on one. I just finished one, and I've got two more kitted up. I just enjoy the challenge that you put forth in those designs with the various stitches, and making me use sometimes threads I don't want to use. And
which threads do you not want to use? Not saying I want design with them, but which threads do you not like?
The slippery stuff.
Oh, the rayons. Okay.
I hate rayon. I just hate it. Oh.
See, I love rayon, and that's probably why I use so much of it, because I really like the texture of it. I like the way the light reflects off of it, and I don't have very much trouble stitching with it. I know a lot of people do, but for some reason I don't. And I don't know if it's that I'm having trouble and I just put up with it because I like the results or, I don't know.
You're making me better at it. I'll tell you that.
Good.
I used to. I wasted so much early on. I just wasted so much of it. And now I don't that, but it's, I just take my time and I'm patient and grit my teeth every now and then, and I'm fine.
You have to beat it into submission. I guess that's the only thing. It's like a recalcitrant child. And
it is that, yes.
You have to know how to work with that. We had a child who was a little difficult, and we had to learn how to work with him. And, you know, so one of the things that when I first started using rayon, everyone said to dampen it. And so I started doing that. And then I discovered I was stitching with the same thread side by side, some that had been dampened, some that had not been. And there was a significant difference in the shine when I dampened the thread. So I stopped dampening it altogether. I just don't dampen it anymore. And what I do use is a little mini flat iron, and I iron it before I stitch with it. And that seems to help somewhat. So.
Oh, there's my tip for the day, because see, I dampen it.
Well, do a little experiment and see if you can see the difference. I was working with neon rays.
Yep.
And I was actually stitching on an airplane and didn't have access to dampen my thread. And so I just, okay, whatever. And in looking at it, there was such a difference in the shine that I said, okay, not ever doing that again. So I iron it.
All right.
I keep a lot of tension on it. Both above the canvas when I'm pulling a stitch up and below the canvas when I'm taking a stitch down. And that seems to help as well.
So can you describe to me, so I'll be the neophyte here with needlework, because I haven't done anything since the old days of terrible acrylic, quote unquote, wool and painted canvases. So when you're stitching with rayon, what is the difficulty? Because I'm imagining it like sewing with chiffon. Because, you know, there you have the fabric just slides against each other and doesn't ever stay true. So is that the same thing here, or is there some other difficulty that makes it less fun to work with?
I think that with regular threads like cotton and with silk and with wool, some people call it a grain. I don't want to call it a grain because I've never been able to find the grain in it. But they are like little pieces that stick out. You know, you can't see them.
Mm-hmm. But right.
And I think that when you're going through a canvas with those kinds of threads, that they have a tendency to catch on the similar little pieces that are sticking out in the canvas. And so they kind of lock into place and they're not as difficult to stitch with. But with rayon, with neon rays, rayon floss and things like that, they don't have any of that. And so I think that's what makes them a lot slipperier, and they're not willing to lock into the canvas until you take the next stitch. And we're so accustomed to having the thread lock into the canvas when we take a stitch that it's a difficult thing to remember, okay, I've got to hold this in place while I bring the needle up to start the next stitch. And so that's another thing that I do is I put my thumb on the stitch as I'm bringing the needle up to start the next stitch, just to hold it in place so it doesn't slip around.
Yeah. Now see, there's another subtlety right there. I'm going to try that too, because I tend to stitch as if I'm using cotton or silk, and boy, it just misbehaves all the time. All right. I'm trying that. So tension on both sides, use my thumb to hold it in place, and iron don't dampen. Okay.
Right. Give that a try. And I think the ironing has a tendency to, and I also think that there may be a little static electricity normally in a rayon thread.
Yes.
The way it moves against each other. And I think the ironing helps to release some of that. So, that's what I do. And, you know, there's still times when I have difficulty with every thread. It's just, when I demonstrate in my classes, especially, you know, if it knots, underneath or whatever. The class is always absolutely delighted to find
yes,
out.
Yes, yes, of course.
It's not just me.
You know, designers aren't given some magic formula that we don't share with anybody else about how to work with different threads. I mean, we have all the same problems that every stitcher has with the thread knotting up and then having to untangle it and sometimes just cutting it out because I just don't want to take the time to mess with it. And threads that don't lay the way I want them to lay and, you know, threads that don't stay in place. I mean, we all designers have this exact same issue.
Good to hear. Good to hear.
Well, and the only reason why I say that is because my classes tell me, oh, I'm so glad you're having problems with that because I have problems with that. It's like, okay, well, you know, we're just people. We're not magical or anything.
Yeah. And I'm so jealous of you. You mentioned stitching on the plane. I travel all the time. I'm gone at least 2 weeks of the month for 2 or 3 days. And I can never get, you know, as a male in this hobby, I can never get past the, because it's a lot of hours that I sit on a plane that I could be stitching.
Yeah.
And I just can't get past the social stigma part of that. It really frustrates me.
For it. Nobody's looking at you. And if they do, they're looking to see what you're doing, not because you're a guy doing it.
I agree. And it really makes those flights fly by. Like never fly without a ball of yarn or some sort of project. Always, even car rides, you know, car rides, I have my knitting bag with me or whatever little crochet project I'm working on. And it's, but I'll tell you this, Gary, though, no matter what you're doing, if you're doing any kind of stitchery, the person next to you is always going to be looking at you because they're wondering what you're doing, because I don't think that many people do this on planes. No. So it's not a guy thing that maybe you might have 10% more attraction than you would. But as women, we get exactly the same thing. People look at you.
They're just wanting to see what you're doing because mm-hmm. a lot of them are not exposed to it. You know, see, my grandmother, both of my grandmothers sewed. They both made quilts, but one of my grandmothers also did hand embroidery. And I remember her making Barbie clothes for us and doing chicken scratch on it. It was cross stitches on gingham, and she did chicken scratch on her Barbie clothes. And so I grew up seeing people stitching, but a lot of people today never see anybody stitching. Their mothers don't stitch. Their grandmothers don't stitch. They never see anybody stitching. And so when they see somebody stitching, whether it's a male or female, they're just really intrigued by it. And
I agree.
I have to tell you, I frequently will take Amtrak from Little Rock up to Chicago, and you talk about opportunity to stitch. Well, for one thing, it's a lot more comfortable than it is on an airplane. Mm-hmm. But I will frequently take my stitching and go and sit in the observation lounge. And one time, this young man was so fascinated by what I was doing, sat down beside me so he could watch me stitch. Then he went back and got some more of his friends to come watch me stitch. And, you know, so he had this real audience, but it was a guy. So, you know, Gary, don't be afraid of just be bold and go for it. And the curiosity that you're going to attract is because people are interested in what you're doing, not who's doing it.
All right. I'll suck it up. I'm off to Vegas next week for a trade show, so I'll suck it up.
I agree. And this is going to be wonderful because in our other hobby that we're coming from where we do our other podcast, I am the vast minority there. So for me to go into a plumbing store, for example, and ask for something there, I get exactly that experience all the time. And it's become, at first it was annoying and weird, and now it's just become kind of delightful because people are always surprised that I am doing this. So I think, Gary, you should take a note from that and just, you know, own it and be that person.
Well, and I think that so when I started stitching back in the 80s, that's when I basically started stitching. Everybody was cross-stitching. Everybody was cross-stitching. I would go to church, and people would have their basket of cross-stitching with them at church, not during service, but, you know, while we were waiting for our kids to get us something or whatever. And so I said, I'm not going to cross-stitch. I knew how because my grandmother had taught me, and she had taught me several embroidery stitches. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do this. It's a big time sink. I'm not going to get into it. And then I did. And I carried it with me everywhere. And so, but it wasn't unusual when I was stitching because everybody else was stitching. That was during the big boom time of cross stitch, where counted cross stitches kind of took off. It was coming out of the stamped cross stitch or the stenciled things, you know, the ant
blocks
that you could buy and iron on a pillowcase. It was coming out of that, and people were stitching on sweatshirts and on towels and pictures, and the county cross stitch looked more refined than the stamped cross stitch. And so people began doing that. Floss was relatively inexpensive. I think at the time we could get 10 skeins for a dollar.
Yes.
In places like that. And Hobby Lobby had three or four aisles devoted to cross-stitch patterns. And so it was everybody that I saw was doing it. And now I'm more of a rarity because the fiber arts kind of have a swing where when cross-stitch is really big, yarn is down. And when yarn is really big, needlepoint is down. And when needlepoint starts to swing back up, then the other forms aren't quite as interesting. The only needle art that really remains constant throughout is quilting. So, you know, it's just interesting to watch the ebb and flow because when I first started doing the National Needle Arts Association trade shows, fully three-fourths of the convention center floor was devoted to yarn. And then it gradually got smaller and smaller and smaller. And needlepoint is getting bigger. And so I'm really happy to see this because painted canvas is frightfully expensive.
Yes.
Because it's hand-painted. And so people are, they see it and they want to do it and they go, oh, my gosh, I can't spend that kind of money. And then they find counted again. So I am really hopeful that counted is going to come back up. I don't think it will be the way it was in the 80s, but I hope it will be better than it has been in the last 10 years.
So, okay, so that's interesting you would bring that up because, I mean, painted, at least in my area, hand-painted canvases, I mean, that's just what just about everybody's doing. I just don't happen to get excited about that. I much prefer the counted and the various stitches, and I it's just what interests me, you know, expensive those canvases aside, it's just what interests me. But so you see that happening in that counted needlepoint is kind of on a downswing elsewhere. Do you see that?
It has been on a downswing. When everybody started knitting back in the early 2000s, Christine, I'm sure you remember this.
Yes.
Everybody was knitting. And you saw, you know, celebrities were knitting and people were knitting everywhere. And yarn stores sprang up. And it was just really easy to see this and go, oh, well, I want to do this too. And especially younger people got really involved with knitting. And then we had the web, then Ravelry started.
Yes, right.
That, you know, just really helped to fuel the fire. Well, unless you were going to do more than knit a scarf on great big huge needles, you then we're going to have to take some lessons and learn how to do something different. And at that point, after they had knitted 18 scarves for everybody that they knew, then they stopped knitting.
I think that's true. And it became sort of a trendy thing for young people to do. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the hipster hobby here in New York.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So hats and scarves, and you're right, but you don't see anybody doing anything more complex.
Right. And so, you know, in order, if you're going to advance in that hobby, you're going to have to learn how to do sleeves and do a sweater and do buttons and do
cables and intaglia and things like that.
Yeah, and all of that. And a lot of people go, okay, well, this is too hard now, and I don't want to. And it's not that it's hard. It's just that a lot of people are self-taught. And YouTube especially is fabulous for seeing all kinds of techniques and things like that. But a lot of people are self-taught, and they don't want either the time or the expense of taking a class to learn more. The ones who are really interested in the hobby, they will do that. But the ones who aren't, not so much. I mean, and so at that point, then they go, okay, well, what else can I do? And we see this with all kinds of crafts and hobbies and stuff. I mean, I remember when stamping and paper crafts were really
yes.
Cool. And, you know, there were four or five different stamping stores in the Little Rock area, and now there are none.
Right. That whole thing, that just flashed up and flamed out before
yeah.
I even got.
You know, yep. I see this happening with all hobbies and crafts, and except for quilting. Quilting always remains constant. But, you know, I see this with all of them. And so, you know, I think that we just need to be, and it always kind of reinvents itself a little bit because, back in the 80s, I think it was right before I started doing cross stitch. I had a knitting machine. I still have my knitting machine. It's up in the attic. And I make sweaters and stuff like that, and knitting machines were really popular. And now you don't ever hear anybody talking about knitting machines anymore. And this was a huge investment. I mean, it's like $1,500 for me to get a knitting machine. Mm-hmm. And I worked with it and learned how to use it and all that, and took a class or two where I bought it and stuff like that. But now... And then when knitting reinvented itself, it reinvented itself on great big needles with a lot of different kinds of yarns that have, you know, sequins in them and fibers coming off of them and stuff like that.
Right. And, eyelash yarn and things
yeah,
of that nature.
Exactly. And ribbon and people stitching, knitting with all kinds of different things. And so it kind of reinvented itself. And so I'm waiting to see how cross stitch is going to, and I talk about cross stitch and painted canvas because charted is right between those two. Charted canvas is for people who like to work with a lot of different threads, like you can with a painted canvas, and a lot of different kinds of stitches, like you can with a painted canvas, but they want to start from scratch, if you will, with a blank piece of fabric, like with county cross stitch. And a lot of that is due to the expense. But I have seen, and I don't spend a lot of time on Etsy or Pinterest or, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with them, but I don't spend a lot of time there. And I have seen a lot of younger people, and they are interested in stitching these little pixelated characters, you know, like based on Star Wars and Big Bang Theory, and you can do pixelated characters of your whole family and stuff like that. And so
interesting.
This is what they are more drawn to. They're not drawn to a basket of flowers or, you know, a cat or, back in the 80s when I started cross stitching, it was geese with blue gingham ribbons around their necks.
Oh, yes. And roosters. Right?
Yeah. Right.
Right.
So,
lots of country style things of that nature. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it was the big living room canvas, which was the tiger or
yeah.
the eagle on a branch or the wolf howling at the moon. Right?
Exactly. You know, the great big huge Mirabilia is, or the lavender and lace, the big
yes.
and the stuff like that. And so, you know, I'm kind of waiting to see how cross stitch and kind of reinvents itself, because I think that it probably will swing back up because, it, you know, all of this is cyclical.
You know, it brings up something that I've noticed with crafts in general, but needlework in particular. There are plenty of crafts that if you go through any kind of craft store or yarn shop or thing that you would love to make, that it would be challenging to make, it would be enjoyable to do, but then it's not something you would ever actually want to own, right? So
yeah.
I run into that problem of, oh, that looks really interesting, but what am I going to do with it afterwards? So finding something like your designs where it's something that's challenging to do, it's interesting, but it's also beautiful enough that I would actually want to own it is nice, you know, because it is the opposite of those, you know, wolf howling at the moon things, because then when you're done with it, you gift it to your least, you know, favorite sibling or something like that. So,
well, and that brings up another thing. A lot of people view crafting, whether it's stitching or knitting or wood painting or, you know, anything, as a gifting thing, something that they make for other people and not something that they keep for themselves. And I'm different because when I started stitching, I kept it for myself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think the one of the first few things that I cross stitched were towels as thank you gifts for my kids' teachers at the end of the year. I think that's about the only thing I've ever given away. I just it takes too much time for me to want to invest that kind of time in something that I'm not going to keep. And
right.
Also, you run a real risk that the recipient does not appreciate the time and effort that you've put into this. And I hear this all the time from stitchers. Well, I spent all this time and I made this wedding sampler for my niece or whatever, and she hung it in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
You did flowers and your niece doesn't like flowers. You did purple and your niece likes blue.
Yep.
And, you know, so unless you are going to really take the time and kind of collaborate with the recipient, to me, it's not worthwhile to stitch things for gifts. Now, I know there's a lot of people who disagree with me, and that's fine. It's just in my experience, what I have seen is that gifting someone what you have crafted is a really touchy thing, because if they don't appreciate it as much as you do, then your feelings get hurt.
Yeah, and I've had that experience, and I'm very hesitant anymore to stitch as a gift, very hesitant. And in defense of the recipient, very difficult for them to fully appreciate what goes into a decent piece of needlepoint or embroidery or whatever. You know, they just can't, unless they've done it themselves, can't really appreciate it. But still, you put all that energy and you want it to, and you just got to be extra perfect because it's going to be a gift. And then it's like, oh, that's nice. Thanks. And
they hang it in the closet.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that hurts. You know, no matter what, it hurts.
It hurt.
Yeah.
And I mean, consider that if I bought a gift for someone and gave it to them and they didn't like it, my feelings would be hurt about that too. But here I've spent 200 hours. And
right.
all of the materials, because, you know, on the average, one of my pieces, even the smallest piece, is going to be over $100 by the time you've bought all of the canvas and the threads and stretcher bars and needles and laying tools and everything that you need to stitch. And that's just a smaller piece.
Right.
So, you know.
Then if you have it custom framed.
Oh yeah. I didn't even want to go there.
Yeah, but right. but I mean that's very much crazy. That's very much the cost too is when you go to all that, and then so that little 6x6 piece, you know, you're up a couple hundred bucks or more, and that's a heck of a gift to give someone.
it is a big heck of a gift to give someone, and if I had someone that cared that much about me that they wanted to give me a $200 or $300 gift, I'd rather it be jewelry.
There we go.
I'm just saying.
Hey Debbie, let's go back a little bit now. Christine and I, before in our little introduction, we were talking about how we got started in the fiber arts, and both of us, it was grandmas and mothers and the usual childhood experiences. And it sounds like same thing for you. So how is it that you get from that childhood experience to, I assume you became a very serious stitcher before you became a serious designer? What's the transition that happens there that takes you to someone who is one of the more visible designers in the business today?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of it has to do with my location, because before we lived here in Conway, Arkansas, I lived in Moore, Oklahoma. And there was a family stitching store that I went to, but I didn't know anybody else who stitched, even though there was a stitching store that I went to. I didn't know anybody. I had never heard of American Needlepoint Guild, Embroiderers Guild of America. I didn't know anything about any of those. And I stitched purely because I wanted to for me. And I stitched big projects, like a big afghan. And in fact, the regular afghan wasn't big enough, so I did two of them put together. I was on the thing for a whole year. And I did the Marbeck nativity, you know, the 5-panel nativity thing. And I did Christmas stockings for my family and stuff like that. Then we moved to Conway, and in Little Rock, and I stitched alone by myself. There was not a stitching store here. I didn't know anybody else who stitched. But in Little Rock, there was a company called Leisure Arts, and a friend of mine told me that she knew that I stitched, and she said they were looking for model stitchers. Okay, fine. So I went and applied. I took in my big afghan. I took in my Marbeck nativity so they could see that I had done quite a bit of stitching. And while I was there for the interview, I met someone who lived in Conway and said, oh, we have a stitching group. What? was completely floored. I had no idea that people got together to stitch. And so I went to the stitching group. And that first night there, they were working on Heart Honor, which I had never seen in my life. Remember, all I had seen was cross stitch and some of the like embroidery stitches like stem stitch and French knots that my grandmother had done. I had never seen Heart Honor. And I said, that's awesome. I said, I want to learn how to do that. Now, excuse my dogs may bark because there's an airplane and they have to go bark at the airplane. I said, I want to learn how to do that. And they said, well, we had a class in it, but here's the book. And so I took the book and I taught myself how to do Heart Honor. And so I went back to stitching group the next month and they were talking about, they were going to the, I can't remember the name of it. It morphed into the Creative Arts and Textiles show, but before that it was a big needlework show and they were going and it was in Tennessee. And I now remember I had seen these people. This was the second time. Can I go too? I'll drive. And so they said, oh, sure. Okay. And so they showed me the catalog and they were going just to shop in the market, which was huge and big and nice and all of that. But here was 100 classes that they could take. Yeah. And so what classes are you doing? We're not taking any classes. So I said, well, I'm going to take classes. So I took a Heart Honor class and I took, you know, a couple of other different classes. And so the people that went with me decided that they would take a class too. And so at this show, which was in Knoxville, Tennessee in, I want to say 1998, something like that, there was a vendor there who had Gene Hilton's models.
Oh.
I was gobsmacked. I had never seen anything like that in my life, ever. And I spent so much time in this woman's booth that she finally said, are you going to buy anything? I mean, because I was just looking and looking. Of course, you know, you're not supposed to take pictures or anything like that, but which we didn't know. We were informed of that later, but after we had taken some pictures. But anyway, and so, you know, I said, okay, well, you know, let me see. And all she had were kits. And I said, well, you know, I really like this. And even then I knew enough to know that I could change colors if I wanted to. Even though I had never seen this before, I had never done any of these stitches before, and I was completely floored by it. But, you know, I said, well, you know, I'd really like to have the chart only. I don't really need the kit. I've got a lot of these threads at home, and I want to change the peach in it to a pink. Oh, well, you can't change anything in it. That would change to compromise the integrity. So, okay, fine. I didn't buy anything. And then I found a shop in Hot Springs that had some Gene Hilton, not charts, but some of her books, Needlepoint Stitches and Stimulating Stitches. And so I bought both of those. And very first page, Gene Hilton says, feel free to change the colors. And so really that's how kind of I got started and moved from cross stitching, which had, you know, was the only thing I did, into counted canvas and completely self-taught. I think that we had a class that was a little ornament that had eyelets in it and road stitches, and that was it. And I think it had some beads. And the rest of it I did on my own because there was no place where I could go and take a class in it that I knew of at the time. Of course, you know, American Needlepoint Guild and Embroiderers Guild of America was having classes all over, but I wasn't aware of them. And so, that's really how I got started into counted canvas. Was I saw it at a show and was just floored. And, you know, of course, Gene Hilton's designs were, you know, just
yeah,
so awesome. I mean, she's like
special stuff. Yeah. That's,
yeah. And yeah. I actually got to talk to her one time and I was so I didn't actually meet her, but I got to talk to her on the phone one time and I was just, she called me about, our Needle Arts Mystery Retreat that we were having in Hot Springs and she wanted to sign up for it. Yeah. And so I said, oh, just a minute. Let me get a piece of paper and a pencil. And I put my hand over the mouthpiece and start screaming to my husband, it's Gene. Okay, I've got my pen and paper now. Let me help you. I was so excited. It was, and then she didn't get to come because of poor health, and then she died the next year. But, yeah. You know, she has influenced my work more than anything because of the, you know, the Jessicas and the crescents and the, you know, all of the loopy, the walnettos and all of the loopy stitches and things that go under and manipulate the needle and all of that and all of the different threads and the textures that she used. And, you know, she had a whole series of pieces that were all one color. They were different colors, but they were all one color. But the design was conveyed through texture. And I was just so captivated by it.
Yeah.
And that's why I got, that's how really I got started.
Yeah, that's interesting because that's one thing I like about your charts is you always have a table and you always encourage people to try other colors and you have that table in there where they can, where you can write the alternative color that you've chosen. And I always appreciate that because I just, one that I just kitted up, I wanted nothing to do with the colors you'd chosen, but I knew what I wanted. And so it was so easy. And when I went to the needlework store that I buy all my stuff from, that's what the owner, Monica, did was she took what you had spec'd and laid those all out. And then we chose the equivalent in the colors that I wanted. And then, you know, she said, may I write in your chart? Please do, you know, and filled it right in. And
is it Monica Pratt?
Yes. Right. At Welcome Stitchery. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell her hi the next time you see her. She always came in my room at the shows and everything and really lovely person, lovely yep. person.
Yeah. She's terrific. Yeah. But that, you know, and having that chart there, that table, I can just fill them right in. It really helps. So, yeah.
Well, the thing is that a good design can be conveyed in any color. And so I don't really consider the color to be a part of the design. And in fact, when I am doing a design, I design everything in black and white and the color is added right before I stitch. And my philosophy on it is if you don't like the color, you're not going to stitch. And I know this from personal experience because of my, Glitz and Glamour series, which is based on jewel tones and precious metals. And a couple of years ago, I didn't have a yellow one. And a couple of my students asked me to do a yellow one. Well, yellow is my least favorite color. And it took me forever to stitch that thing because I didn't want to stitch with yellow. I didn't like it. And mm-hmm. I didn't want with it. And anytime I incorporate yellow into a design, which is pretty rare, that is the hardest part for me to stitch because I don't like it. And so I think it's pretty arrogant for me to say, oh, no, you must only use the colors that I have selected when just about any color will do. And I would rather that you stitch with a color that you absolutely love and can't wait to see than a color that I've selected that you don't like.
Yes.
So that raises a question, though. So for somebody who is new to this, how many of those people do you think choose the designs based on the color versus how many people are choosing it based on the complexity of the design or the texture or the difficulty level?
Well, I think somebody new just starting out is probably choosing it based on the cover photo, which is the design and the color.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they, and that's why I always give them permission to change the color because a lot of people don't know that they have permission to do that. And so I always give them permission to do that by having that table in there to encourage them to do that. And I say on the back of every chart, feel free to change the colors and the stitches. If you don't like a particular stitch, we'll pick a different one. I don't care. Because when it leaves me, it's now your project. And I would rather you be stitching and enjoying what you're doing because then you'll want to stitch another one than not stitching. So, you know, I think it's a kind of an evolution thing. Gary, when you first started stitching County Canvas, did you go in thinking I'm going to change colors or did you go in thinking I'm going to stitch exactly this?
No, I did not consider changing the color. No, I would choose ones that the colors were appealing to me. But the overriding decision was always the challenge of the stitches. And if I could tolerate the colors, then I'd do the piece. You know, and if I like the colors, then I'd do it with enthusiasm. But it was the challenge. And I think that's where I ended up with your charts I want to see if I can pull that off. You know, can I do the threads like that? As time went on, then yeah, you get more comfortable and you think, wait a minute, I'd rather do this in blues and or I just saw on TV, you know, one inspiration I had was Downton Abbey, and one of the women had a color combination on, and it just stuck in my head, and you know, I got to do that. I got to have that. So the color came later, but for me, it's always the challenge. And I find that interesting that you say you start in black and white, because I'm a photographer. Christine and I have these multi-habit hobby problems.
But, we have a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's okay. But, I have a serial hobbyist in my house too. So.
Okay. But see, I'm a photographer, and to learn serious photography, at least it used to be, and I think it still is, you know, if you want to be successful and learn how to manipulate and capture light, you learn black and white photography. Because you can't hide anything with color in black and white. And so I find it interesting. You're basically doing the same thing by starting in black and white. That tells me you're going for shape and flow and texture, and then we'll tack on the color, and you know, and the color is a personal preference. So that it's interesting that pops up again.
Yeah, and color is such a subjective and personal thing. And there are people that I know that if there is something that has anything that has purple in it, they are drawn to it and they want that. And I'm a blue person. You know, I love blue. I feel most comfortable when I'm wearing blue. And so, you know, I know how personal color is. And, you know, my process is, you know, I will think of something, I'll see something that I think, oh, that might be an interesting shape for a design. And then I sit down at my computer and I chart it out before I begin stitching. And I know there are other designers that start stitching and then do the charting. But for me, it makes more sense to do the charting first, because then I don't have to rip a bunch of stuff out if I didn't get, you know, I need a repeat that's going to go into an area of 144 stitches, and oh, oops, I started with a stitch over 5 and that's not going to work. And then I have to do a lot of compensate. And so it makes more sense to me to do the charting on my computer before I begin stitching, because then I can take things out, put things in as I need to make things fit. And usually while I'm designing, I'm also thinking about, well, what color do I think I want to do this? And then I go to the store, the needlework store here in town, or I go to my stash, which is quite extensive, and start pulling threads. Sometimes I know before I even begin to design, I want to use this particular color combination. But, you know, like with the Glitz and Glamour series that I did, they're all a single color. Every one of them is a single color. And I think there's like 22 or 23 of them now. Any one of them could be done in one color. I mean, if you wanted to do the whole, all 23 of them, make a big wall thing. And I'll just tell you, I don't think I'm through doing these, because it's a nice size and it's fun to play with the texture like that. And there are way more jewels that I have not yet covered.
Okay.
But let's say that, you know, your favorite color or your favorite color combination was blue and brown. You could do every single one of these in blue and brown. Mm-hmm. You do not have to do them in the color that I selected. So, and in fact, there was a guy, Stitcher, who sent me pictures of his Glitz and Glamours that he was doing in blue and brown.
Yeah.
And using them in, as a wall accent in his bedroom.
So he was just going through the series, doing in blue and brown everything.
Yep.
Huh. That's neat.
Yeah. So, you know, to me, the texture is just as important as the color.
Yeah. That's funny you say it about your stash. A good friend was over here not too long ago, and I was showing her my new, I just set up a new stitching area and really happy with it. And everything's put away and it's organized. And she's so terrific. She walks down, she says, she looks and she says, well, Gary, you don't have enough stuff. I think I'm okay, but I didn't realize I was coming up short. And I can just imagine what you do. You must have thread companies in particular, I'm sure, maybe I'm wrong, but shoving thread at you all the time. Try this. Would you use this in a design? Do you get a lot of that?
No.
No?
Mm-mm. Really?
I'm surprised.
No. That has happened a couple of times. Huh. DMC introduced 16 new colors, and they asked me to do a design that used all 16 of the colors. And let me just tell you that that was a real challenge because I didn't think a lot of the colors went together.
Yeah.
But so that was one time when DMC gave me new colors. And there is a thread called Twinkle. and when the distributors of Twinkle wanted to introduce it, they said, can we send you the threads and will you design something? And I liked all of the their jewel colors. They're absolutely stunning. And it's it's a braided thread that's got rayon and metallic braided in together. I loved all of them. And I said, I can't just pick out three or four that I like. So I used all of them. And so those are two occasions that I can think of where, they sent me threads and said, please use these in a design. A lot of times what happens is I can contact a thread company and say, will you send me? And they will send me specific threads or whatever. And they do this for all designers, not just for me, but they do this for all designers because especially with charted, if we call for a thread, most of the time that's exactly what the stitcher wants to use. And so they're going to sell that thread.
Right.
So Rainbow Gallery has done this. You know, they are really good about sending me when they introduce a new line, like when they came out with Entice and Silk Lame Braid. And they've got a new one that they're introducing at the TNNA show that's going on this weekend that is a blend of merino wool and metallic.
Mm.
And I really am eager to work with that because I don't work a lot with wool. And Christine, when I was knitting, I knitted a whole cashmere sweater. And the whole time I was knitting a cowl neck, it was that sea green, beautiful thing.
Mm.
And when the whole time I was working on it, my nose was itching. And I realized after that I was allergic. And so, beautiful sweater that I spent all this time making that I can't wear. So
I'm really surprised at that. I mean, that's marketing 101. I'm really surprised that thread companies aren't shoving stuff at you. That's an interesting thing.
Well, I can get it if I ask for it.
Yeah.
And usually I have to pay for it. There are a couple of thread companies that are just appalled at the idea that a designer would ask them to supply threads to them, which I'm thinking, how long have you been doing this? Because obviously not very long.
No.
The invest, I know about marketing and retail markup and stuff like that. So a thread that I am going to spend $3 for in a store actually is going to cost 30 cents for them to skein it and for the thread. And so even giving a designer a whole thread line is not setting them back. And in fact, introducing new stitchers to their threads, which they will then sell way more of their threads than if they just introduce a line and go, okay, here it is. And stitchers aren't going to pick it up and use most 90% of stitchers are not going to pick up a thread to use unless it's called for in a chart.
Yep. So it's guaranteed sales. Yeah, that's fascinating to me. I don't know.
It's interesting, but everybody gets to do their business the way they want to do their business. I get to do my business the way I want to do my business. And, my business model is, I wholesale only to the shops and they do the retail sales. I have probably two or three requests every week. Can you sell me this chart?
Right.
And I always tell them, I'm sorry, I can't do that. But here are 18 shops that will be more than happy to sell you the chart, or 18 needlework stores that will be more than happy to sell you the chart and the stretcher bars and the canvas and the threads.
Right.
Because I think if I get into starting to sell charts, and, I'm not criticizing designers who do this, okay? This is just my business model and the way I've chosen to do it. Then they're going to say, well, I can't get this thread. Can you sell me this thread? And the next thing you know, I'm a shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do that. So I would much rather send them to Monica and let Monica fix them up, which is more capable of doing. or to any of the other shops, you know, and I'll do the research for them and tell them, well, you know, there's this shop in your area.
Right.
And like the needlework store in our town has been in business for, I think 12 years, and she still has people who live here in our town. And bear in mind that we 70,000 people in our town go into her shop and go, oh my, I had no idea you were here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know if people just aren't looking. And when I was stitching, and traveling around in back when they had phone books in hotel rooms, the first thing I would do is pick up the phone book and look to see, are there any needlework stores to see if I could work out paying them a visit, because I like going to needlework stores.
Right. Sure.
So, you know, I don't quite comprehend not looking, and especially with the internet. I mean, good grief. You can find anything you need on the internet.
Yep.
I don't know how many brick and mortar stores also have a web presence with a shopping cart, and you can just buy anything you want online, even if you don't have a store. And a lot of these, and the thing about the brick and mortars that also have a web presence is if you're not sure, you can call them and say, I want to do this, but I'm not sure about this thread, and they'll help you.
Mm-hmm.
I have not ever seen a single needlework store anywhere that did not excel in customer service.
Right. Well, that's how you stay alive.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So,
that's one of the things I enjoy about Needlepoint Nation. I love watching it. When somebody needs a thread they can't find, within a half an hour, there'll be half a dozen stores that have it for them and are willing to ship it to them. And boy, if there's anything you can't find, Needlepoint Nation, you'll have it within an hour, guaranteed. Oh, it's
absolutely. I love Needlepoint Nation. I love seeing what people are doing. And I especially like it when they're doing one of my designs and they've changed the colors.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And I always try to compliment them. When I see a post like that, I always try to good job and add a girl or add a boy or whatever. And I'm so happy. And I love the colors that you chose, just to encourage.
Yep. Debbie, we're going to have to end this. I hate this. We could go on for another hour, but.
What a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's been very enjoyable for me too. And maybe we can meet sometime when I'm in Chicago.
You can count on it. You can count on it. We're getting together for sure.
Okay.
Yep.
I'll email you and let you know when we're going to be there, and we can get together and maybe stitch some together or go visit a store or something.
I'm up for that. You just let me know. All right.
Okay, Aaron.
All right, Debbie Raleigh, thanks for kicking off our new podcast series, Fiber Talk. We really appreciate the time and hearing from you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It was a great joy for me to participate.